Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The decade of the 80s in the United States was an era of fear, stigma, and confusion as many of the victims of AIDS and HIV were left with hopeless lives punctuated by hateful stigma and isolation. In all, 675,000 Americans have died from complications associated with the disease. There's still no cure, but in the three decades since, a lot has changed in how HIV/AIDS is treated. This week marks the 30th anniversary of the Food and Drug Administration approval of AZT, the first drug successfully developed for the treatment of AIDS. Coming up, we're going to hear about a local staged reading of the Normal Heart to commemorate the anniversary. Joining us now by phone is Associate Dean for Clinical Research in the College of Medicine and Public Health at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, where he has studied HIV and viral infections since the 80s. Dr. Michael Pera also is Medical Director of Equitas Health, formerly the AIDS Resource Center, Ohio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Take us back to the 1980s when the country really had no concept of what was coming down the road. What was it like?
Well, you know, when it started, it was a few cases here and there, and nobody was too alarmed because it was really small numbers. I think it was mostly in the public health community that they saw something they had never seen before and wondered where it was going. But, you know, within a few years and some national figures coming out with having HIV infection, Magic Johnson kind of in the end, but we had Rock Hudson and Arthur Ashe and, you know, a variety of Broadway stars dying. People became much more alarmed about where this is going. We didn't understand it. We didn't understand how it was spread. There was a lot of fear. There were, you know, people proposing that everybody with this needed to be put on an island. So it was, and we didn't understand it, and that was part of it, and that generates a lot of fear when you don't understand what's happening.
Even in the medical field?
Yes. I mean, I do remember people, I mean, I had colleagues that just didn't, I don't want to do this. I didn't get into this field of infections to kind of take care of this kind of problem. This isn't what I wanted to do, spend my career doing. Or you know, we didn't know. And, you know, people would leave in the hospital. People would leave the food on the floor outside the door because they were didn't understand.
Yeah, I remember seeing that back in the 80s. Didn't want to be treated. Of course, we all, you know, there's a scene in The Normal Heart, which we'll be talking about later, which I don't have to talk about with you, but where they wouldn't perform an autopsy to do the cause of death in a case. And,
you know, it was, and actually that, you know, it just shows the power of public health and epidemiology is that I kind of reflect back. I mean, in, so the, it was described in June of 1981, and again, not very many cases, by November of 1982. So it was a while, but it was enough cases for the CDC to study. They had enough data that said, this is how you handle blood from these individuals. This is how you handle, how you relate to them, how you touch them, what you do, whether you need to wear masks. You know, they basically told the medical profession, this will protect you, but you can take care of these people. Not dissimilar to what we saw with Ebola, where there's this hysteria around Ebola, and the CDC studies things and makes these proclamations. It's based on data. And you know, that's actually helped the medical profession. But it wasn't until November of 82 that kind of they had enough data to make a proclamation about this is how you do this.
The disease AIDS or HIV, it's been around a lot longer than the 80s. When did the medical field make the connection between what was going on in a continent, you know, many miles away and what was happening in New York City?
Yeah, you know, it took a while. I think we were so focused on what was going on here that we didn't look until the later 80s and see this epidemic exploding in Africa, or becoming aware of this epidemic in Africa. But, you know, so it took a while to see that, and then people started putting it together. And you know, it it does. When we look at the detailed virology of how we study these viruses evolve, we can kind of guess that this virus, kind of a very closely related virus, lives in chimpanzees and lives in other primate species, and that it probably got into man in the early 1900s, and then kind of, you know, in rural Africa, didn't really do very much, but once it, you know, started getting into the cities of Africa, probably in the 60s, did it start spreading out of there, coming to Haiti and then New York City. And we think, the CDC actually thinks that some of the cases in New York City, they were described in 81, but they were there in the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm. But isolated enough, the connection wasn't drawn.
Right.
Yeah. We're talking about the history of not only AIDS, but of the treatment for AIDS. My guest is Dr. Michael Pera. He's Associate Dean for Clinical Research in the College of Medicine and Public Health at the OSU Wexner Medical Center. He also is the Medical Director at Equitas Health, formerly the AIDS Resource Center of Ohio. So in the field, you were there. You were working at this back in the day. Were you you said some people said, I didn't sign up for this you know, but what were you discouraged from pursuing treatments? I mean, how did the business work?
Well, you know, we're as physicians, we see what comes to us, and mm-hmm. And you know, there's in the 80s there was significant prejudice, and people, you know, gays were often closeted, and this really pulled them out of the closet, and not everybody was comfortable dealing with kind of a more diverse population. And so they just, you know, I can do other work, you know, I don't have to work with these individuals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have to do surgery. I have plenty of people to do surgery on. I don't have to do surgery on people that put me at some risk. And so the ones who worked in it really were committed to it. I remember on the hospital ward, I mean, some of the nurses that were on the infectious disease ward at university kind of moved on and went to other areas, but new ones came in, and the ones who came in were really dedicated and wanted to be there. And, you know, when the university hospital started giving awards to different nursing units on different wards, they came up first. All, you know, right away, the first unit that got an award for their care was that HIV unit, the infectious disease unit, because they were committed.
Can you compare and contrast back then to today? I mean, give us a snapshot of treatments today versus 25, 30 years ago.
You know, until 1996, a diagnosis of HIV infection was a clear-cut death sentence. The drugs were helpful and they may delay things, but nothing was stopping it. And so if you were diagnosed before 1996, when we had enough drugs to put them together that they worked, you were going to die. Nowadays, the medications and the research have brought us to the point where you take one pill a day. It has three drugs in it. One pill a day. People can take one pill a day and be fine. It completely stops the virus from multiplying. The body heals from the infectious, from the virus. The damage the virus done, the body heals from that, and they're going to live a pretty much normal life.
I'm kind of curious, you know, a lot of times in medicine, when you cure or successfully treat something, there are a lot of other ramifications in other diseases that are benefit, you know, ancillarily benefit from the research that's been done on another disease. Has that been the case for AIDS and HIV?
Absolutely. Because it was a population, I mean, honestly, because it was a young population that, you know, had a death sentence over them, they were very willing to participate in research studies. And so there was an explosion of clinical trials being done in individuals with HIV. And because of that, you can develop drugs much quicker. And drugs that had been you know, going slowly in other populations like transplant populations or cancer populations, all of a sudden you could do studies with them and see that they worked. And so the drugs called antifungal drugs that had only been available intravenously and were very toxic, fluconazole is one of them, was developed very quickly and licensed. Then drugs for cytomegalovirus, which is common in transplant patients and cancer patients. Again, drugs for that came out very quickly. And probably one of the things that really kind of really exploded on the scene, we commonly now, when somebody is hospitalized with a serious infection that needs 1 to 3 months of intravenous antibiotics, they get that on at home. They're treated in the hospital and they get their antibiotic at home.
Why is that the case? I mean, what did AIDS research have to do with that?
So what happened was is that there...
I'm sorry, are you there, Dr. Pera?
Yes, okay. I am. So home infusions of antibiotics were just not done very much back then. People were hospitalized for longer periods of time. And when HIV came along, there was a serious infection called CMV in the eye that people would become blind if they didn't get this intravenous therapy. And so I remember one of my first cases of this was a young fella, and I said, well, you need to stay in the hospital for 3 weeks to get this medicine in the vein. And he said, the heck I will. You're going to figure out. I'm not staying in this stinking place for 3 weeks. I'm dying. He said, I'm not staying here. You're going to figure out how I'm going to get it at home. And so, you know, I called around until I found somebody who would do this. And literally this home infusion therapy literally exploded early in the HIV epidemic for the treatment of this CMV retinitis, which kind of affected about a quarter of the patients. And literally from that, this became kind of a standard thing we do now is give. I mean, there are other things that kind of pushed us that way, but it was HIV actually that kind of brought it out into the community.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, only 1 in 4 who are HIV positive are receiving optimal treatment needed to keep the virus under control. So you've already described how you take a pill, it has 3 different drugs in it, and you're good to go. What's the reason? Is it just affordability?
No, actually, it's multiple things. One, a quarter of people aren't diagnosed. They just don't get tested, so they don't know they have it.
Okay.
And then the diagnosis, a lot of people still have this idea that I'm going to die or this is really, really serious. I don't want to deal with it. And because it takes a decade or so for people to kind of go from infection to sick, they just, like most of us, I don't want to deal with this right now. And literally about 20% of people who receive a diagnosis of HIV infection don't go to see a doctor until they're much sicker. So that's another 20% or so. And then the ones that see a doctor once, the chances of them going back drops about another 10%. So right away, we're at not diagnosed, not want to address it, not want to follow up with it. And you're like at 40% or so of people aren't getting care. And then the truth is that people who come in and stay in care usually one way or another can get, at least up to this point, can get medications. And so, you know, part of it is young people don't want to acknowledge that they're at risk, or if they're diagnosed, don't want to kind of come up to the fact that I am sick. I mean, that's the hardest thing I deal with is telling a 30-year-old, you think you're invincible, you've been healthy your whole life, you now have a fatal illness. I don't do it so bluntly, but you have something you need to take a pill every day, you need to see a doctor on a regular basis. And that's kind of a hard slap in the face for somebody who thinks they're invincible.
We're talking about the history of the AIDS virus in the United States, also the history of treatment for AIDS and HIV. My guest right now, Dr. Michael Pera. He's Associate Dean for Clinical Research in the College of Medicine and Public Health at OSU Wexner Medical Center. And he's been working on these issues for some 30 years since the AIDS crisis really burst onto the scene. If you have a question or comment, we welcome your calls. We welcome your emails. The call number is 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. More than 33 million people are currently living with HIV/AIDS around the world, including 1.2 million Americans. There's still no cure, but researchers have come a long way in developing treatments since the height of the epidemic in the 1980s. This week marks the 30th anniversary of the Food and Drug Administration approval of AZT, the first drug successfully developed for the treatment of AIDS. Coming up, we'll hear about a local staged reading of The Normal Heart, which looks at the movement, the AIDS activism movement from the 1980s. We're going to talk about that to commemorate the 30th anniversary. Still with us by phone is HIV expert and medical director of Equitas Health, Dr. Michael Pera. Dr. Pera, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And joining us now is Dr. Kate Adams. She's the pharmacy manager and a clinical specialist at the AIDS Healthcare Foundation in Columbus. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This month, I want to go straight to some policy issues. This month, House Republicans introduced the American Healthcare Act, legislation that would repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Equitas Health has published that it opposes the proposed plan. Can you tell us, Dr. Pera, why that is?
Well, their concern is that a lot of the patients who receive Medicare, and I wrote a letter to the editor about this 2 days ago, about probably half or a little more than half of my patients either are on Medicaid, Medicare, or buy their insurance through the Affordable Care Act. All of those are threatened by this new bill that's being proposed. The kind of average cost for HIV medicines, life-saving medicines, is about $28,000, $30,000 a year. And so that's not something an individual can, not many individuals can pay themselves. And so they need some sort of help to do this. There have been programs, and Medicaid is the kind of biggest program that's helped people get these life-saving medicines. And so I think it's not only Equitas, it's the AMA, it's the American, you know, it's everybody.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely concern all the way around, for sure.
Yeah.
Kate Adams, can you tell us why it costs so much money for the treatment?
Well, certainly some of it makes sense. There's a lot of clinical trials. There's a lot of development that goes into these medications.
So it's supporting the cost of all that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of two sides to every story. However, we see a lot of things that some people may say some of the huge drug manufacturers are making a whole lot of money on these medications. And is all of it warranted? Probably not. For instance, some of the medications just now, the AIDS Healthcare Foundation does like to stand up for the little guy. We do a lot of talk about Gilead and big pharma greed, and did we necessarily know that some of these medications, they've just reformulated almost every drug that Gilead makes into a newer, better drug that is almost exactly the same with a slight difference in one component, tenofovir component of the drug. So now they have two drugs that are almost exactly the same.
But because they're slightly different.
So now Gilead has, like 7 single tablet regimen. They're not all single tablet regimen, but like all of these medications that are on the market now. And perhaps it's because one of them may be going generic soon. And did they know about this prodrug to begin with? There was some talk that perhaps they did, and they came out with the other one first. And I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Dr. Vera, but there is certainly some thought that there's definitely a reason why a lot of that money comes up front. There's clinical trials or safety and efficacy trials. There's a lot of money that needs to go into this to make sure that these drugs are safe, that they're, there's a lot of FDA approvals. There's all these things that go into it. However, is all of it warranted? Is there price gouging? Is there big pharma greed? Yeah, there is. And that's certainly something that we're trying to be able to, by using things such as 340B pricing, which is a government thing for nonprofit or aid service organizations and things, we're able to pass on. And these are government-funded pricing that we're able to get through AIDS Healthcare Foundation. Equitas Health is able to get it because they're a nonprofit. We're able to pass those price savings on to our patients, and it kind of bypasses that huge price gouge that gets passed on.
Would that be affected by whatever's been whatever's being debated regarding the American Health Care Act in Washington?
The 340B part of that would not. However, there was a huge thing just this past this past summer, trying to get rid of a lot of the 340B. Component of pricing and not allowing that to go through, and that was a huge issue. A lot of litigation went into that to make sure that was still going to be around, because that would have been a enormous issue for Equitas, for AHF, for all the aid service organizations, and not just aid service organizations, because there's other. It's not just HIV and AIDS that would have been affected with 340B pricing, but a lot of other disease states as well. So that 340B pricing is a government-funded pricing where you're a covered entity and you're able to take advantage of reduced funded pricing. And there was a lot of litigation and a lot of talk about doing away with that, and that would have been a huge. It would have been extremely detrimental, and now we're seeing this. So this new legislation looking at these changes in law with healthcare. So, you know, and Ohio was a Medicaid expansion state, so
right. We
were able to get a lot of patients into Medicaid that may or may not have been able to get into it before. Mm-hmm. And then these patients, we were able to get them onto these Medicaid expansions, manage Medicaid plans, that they were actually able to afford their medication. So there's going to be a lot of scrambling because we can't let our patients lapse in therapy, because then we see resistance. We see patients that are these are all just barriers to adherence, so barriers to therapy.
And Dr. Pera already noted that there are enough barriers,
yes.
Stigma
is
still associated with
absolutely.
It, and people just not getting the age and that sort of thing.
And just one more to add to it.
Yeah.
And just a point here.
Mm-hmm.
When people are treated, they become much maybe a thousandfold less likely to give it to somebody else. If
exactly.
they're adequately treated, the epidemic will die. I mean, they've actually had mathematical models that if everybody's treated, AIDS will disappear in, 30 years.
So those patients are virally suppressed. They're not able
they
to
They can't. They don't
transmit.
Infect others.
It is.
Oh.
Probably a thousandfold less likely they'll infect somebody if they're treated. So treatment actually prevents spread of the epidemic.
It's a public health issue. It's not
a personal
life thing.
Yeah. If they're treated and if they maintain that adherence, that compliance, so it's like my job as the pharmacist to keep them adherent on their medication and to hurdle those barriers. So, and then when we see all of these other barriers coming in that are, you know, these healthcare issues, all these other things. And so first there's a stigma, then there's these other, so many barriers to cross. But like Dr. Perez said, if we get that patient virally suppressed, they're, you know, if they're completely undetectable and they're virally suppressed and they're taking their medication regularly and we've crossed all those hurdles and the likelihood of them transmitting this disease to another person is, I don't want to say zero, but it's extremely, extremely minimal. And some people have said zero. So it's something where, like Dr. Perez said, this would make the disease die out at some point. And, you know, it's these barriers.
And can't get any better than that.
Absolutely.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's been 30 years since the AIDS treatment drug AZT was approved by the Food and Drug Administration. We're kind of on that note talking about the history of AIDS and the history of AIDS and HIV treatment, for that matter. You just heard from Dr. Kate Adams. She's pharmacy manager and a clinical specialist at the AIDS Healthcare Foundation in Columbus. Also with us is Dr. Michael Pera. He's Associate Dean for Clinical Research in the College of Medicine and Public Health at the OSU Wexner Medical Center, and he's Medical Director of Equitas Health, formerly the AIDS Resource Center, Ohio. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Pera, is there an ethical thing when it comes to what the pharmaceutical companies are doing by adding ingredients to AIDS treatment if I had AIDS and I had a choice between the newest thing and something generic, I'd want the newest thing.
Yeah, I think it depends. All this, you know, it's highly mm-hmm. variable. But, you know, there is no doubt the drugs are getting better and safer and kind of easier to take and less side effects. And so there's a gradual evolution over, you know, these 30 years from AZT, which was quite toxic, to, mm-hmm. to very good drugs. And then it's a question of why is it? I had a patient who was working in Turkey and he came and he says, I got the drug and the exact drug from the same company in Turkey for 10% what I'm paying here.
Right.
You know, and
I hear that too.
And so why are our costs for medicine, actually all of medical care, why are they so much higher mm-hmm. than it is in the rest of the world?
Because we can afford it, right?
Well, I think that's part of it. I mean, you know,
as a nation,
go back to AZT, the advocates back at that time in 87, 88, actually, when AZT came out, it was the only medicine for a fatal disease, and it was priced at $6,000 a year. And that was an outrageous price at the time. And they chained themselves to Wall Street to close it down, because the company that was selling it didn't develop the drug, didn't do the basic research studies on the drug in people, and only got it kind of from the government to sell it. And so is there an ethical thing? I think there's always an ethical thing. I you can just pick any medicine out mm-hmm. and go, geez, in 1998 when it first came out, it was $11,000 a year for whatever medicine, and now it's $60,000 a year. The medicine hasn't changed, but the price has gone up sixfold in whatever, you know, 12, 14 years.
Right.
Why is that? I don't know.
Let's talk about another milestone in HIV treatment and prevention, the antiretroviral drug Truvada. Mm-hmm. It was approved by the FDA in 2012. The pre-exposure prophylaxis can reduce the risk of HIV infection by more than 90%, but without insurance, it's expensive, about $1,300 per month. How does Truvada work?
So it's if you will, it's kind of like malarial prophylaxis. You have a drug, a medication that will prevent the infection. It because it can kill the virus. And so if you're exposed to HIV or malaria and you have the drug in your system to start with, you don't need as much drug as you do to kind of kill all the virus that might be in a body, but you need at least a little bit of drug that'll stop that small amount of infection that you're exposed to. And so the caveat with that drug is that because you could be exposed to it anytime you have sex, you need to take the drug regularly to have it in your body ahead of time to keep from getting an infection.
And I'll add in, too, we actually work with a really high-risk group in Columbus. One of our we work with a high-risk group, so not just high-risk sexually, but intravenous drug users as well. So if we see high-risk intravenous drug users, we have a group in Austin, Indiana, that we work with who they were declared an epidemic area, and it was actually about a year and a half ago it was declared an epidemic area there.
And it was because of IV drug use.
Much different population base than we have here, and my patients in Chicago, where we have two healthcare centers. That area, much of our patient base there, unfortunately, have been through, many of them are high-risk sexual, a lot of them prostitution, unfortunately. And even if they're using condoms with prostitution, unfortunately, those a lot of those women are put into situations where they may have unwanted sexual advances because they're put in that situation. So, but unfortunately, IV drug
And before
use,
you're getting raped, you don't say, by the way, can you
exactly,
put a condom on,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. So, unfortunately, you're putting yourself in a situation where you may you're much higher risk of being raped, but also the IV drug use. So even if they're not using IV drugs, a lot of them have boyfriends that are using IV drugs. So the boyfriend may become infected and then, you know, so they're at high risk. So it's a whole.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting. I'm glad you brought that up because Dr. Pera, I mean, does universe of infection has changed a lot over the last 20 years with the epidemic of particularly synthetic opioid use and IV drug use and that kind of a thing. Does it change how you do your job?
Well, I think, you know, we want to get people treated because, again, even if they're injection drug users, if we can treat them, they're less likely to transmit it sexually to somebody else.
Yes.
So,
yes.
And so it becomes more – so what it means is that we test those individuals for HIV very regularly to be sure that we catch it as soon as we can before they spread it to somebody by sharing a needle or by sexual contact. So what it does is kind of prompts us to – and because the drugs are so good now, we need to test as many people who might be exposed because once, as we talked about, once we treat them, they're less likely to give it to somebody else.
And is that community of people who may be infected or, you know, are have high risk behavior when it comes to the drug thing. I mean, if I'm gay, that's one thing. But if I'm a drug abuser, that's a whole nother thing in terms of reliability, showing up for appointments, even caring enough to take care of it.
You know, it's interesting. I see two sides of it with some patients.
I mean,
some
I'm talking about stereotypes, of course.
Right. And it's a certain patient.
It's a personality
amazing,
thing.
Okay. Some patients are amazing at keeping that appointment. They know that they have a chronic illness now. They're going to continue to use. Others, they're super hard to find. I have an advocate in Indiana who goes out on the street
That's
in a mobile testing
is
unit,
for people.
And she goes out to look for the patients. And oftentimes they're living in the sister's backyard tent, blah blah blah. Yeah, but she goes out to seek out the patients to bring them in. And if they're on PrEP, so if they're on Truvada for PrEP, they have to come in and get tested to make sure that they're still negative because I think Dr. Pera pointed out when they're taking Truvada for PrEP, they have to continually be tested to make sure that they are still negative because if you have a patient who takes I always liken it to birth control. If you take it once in a while and then you don't take
it,
and then you have sex, I mean, it's like the condom breaks.
It's unreliable, yeah.
So, I mean, you have to take it when you're, you know, so it's something that you can't take just Truvaga. We have to kind of really press that. If you're HIV positive, so if you do become positive and you're taking just Truvada, we can have a whole issue with resistance. So you have to make sure that you follow up and get those clinic visits and make sure that you do remain negative.
Yeah. Dr. Kate Adams, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. And it was an honor actually to be with you too, Dr. Pair.
Thank you, Kate.
If everybody's aware, but Dr. Pair is a renowned research scientist in HIV and a wonderful doctor. So thank you so much for being on with me.
Thank you.
Dr. Kate Adams is a pharmacy manager and a clinical specialist at the AIDS Healthcare Foundation in Columbus. And, of course, Dr. Michael Pera, thank you. I agree. I second that those notions. Thank you so much for joining
us.
Thank you. Michael Pera, Associate Dean for Clinical Research in the College of Medicine and Public Health at the OSU Wexner Medical Center, also Medical Director at Equitas Health, formerly the AIDS Resource Center of Ohio, and, of course, world-renowned in his field. Thanks again for joining us. Coming up, we're going to take, through the prism of art, consider the early days of the AIDS crisis. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about the history of HIV/AIDS in the U.S. Playwright Larry Kramer wrote The Normal Heart. It's a play about gay New Yorkers struggling with AIDS and AIDS activism in the 1980s. And not just gay New Yorkers, but also the researchers behind them. 30 years later, his Tony Award-winning play was turned into an HBO film. In one scene, the main character, played by Mark Ruffalo, calls upon his lawyer brother, who is straight, to help fund the fight in ending the spread of AIDS.
Agreeing that you were born just the same as I was born isn't going to save your dying friends.
That is exactly what is going to save my dying friends.
You make it sound like I'm the enemy.
I am beginning to think that you and your straight world are our enemy. I am furious with you and every goddamn doctor who made me feel it was sick to love a man. I am trying to understand why nobody gives a that we're dying.
Welcome to live radio. The Short North Stage is producing a staged reading of The Normal Heart this weekend. For more information on that, there's several readings. Visit the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now is co-founder and executive producer of The Short North Stage, Rick Gore. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ann.
And director of A Normal Heart production at The Short North Stage, Elliot Lemberg. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why is The Normal Heart, Elliot, still important today, 30 years later, 30 years after the approval of AZT?
And it's such a powerful piece of theater, just a remarkable piece of theater. And it resonates, I think, even more today than it might have at the time, because we have that distance and we can kind of appreciate the historicity of it. But we're in a very similar situation now that we were back in the 80s. And a lot of the issues that are discussed in the play regarding healthcare are back in the news. And so we want to ensure that everyone has access to affordable care. And one of the characters in the play even makes mention of that in the very first scene, that people deserve access to affordable health care, and they need that care. And if they don't have that care, then they should fight for it. And that is one of the major underlying messages of this play. And I think it's a powerful message that continues to resonate with audiences.
One of the things that affects me about the story and the play, and then, you know, the HBO, whatever, however it takes form, Rick Gore, is the iterations of activism. And it really came into kind of stark relief for me how many layers of activism went into this back in the 80s.
Yes, I was very much alive and experiencing. My brother died of AIDS, and it was a time in which there was true terror out there. You didn't know what caused it. Your brother was sick. Were you going to get sick if you got near him? But in terms of the levels of activism, I think what the play shows is these beyond a polemic, which it is. It's a very angry play. It's also a very human play, and that every character. And I think we've discovered this more as the play has been done and the movie has been done. The characters are very rich. They're human beings of all types. They all have their fears. Even though they don't behave very well sometimes, we understand them and we can feel for them. And I think that that's everybody's active in their own way and because they have their own feelings.
Right. I mean, there's always the vanguard, you know, the Larry Kramer type person who's out there out front, the angry, vocal. But then there's the researchers. There's the brother who does eventually, you know, pitch in and help.
And he does. And I think that's a core relationship in the play between Ned Weeks and his brother Ben, because Ben's been taking care of him for many, many years. He manages his finances. You know, he acts as almost a father figure to him. But he doesn't fully accept Ned. I mean, he does everything up to the point of accepting him and accepting the fact that he's gay and he's the same as him. And that was what we heard in the clip that you aired from the HBO film. And that's a very powerful moment in the play between these two brothers, because we know they love each other. We know they care about each other. But, you know, the politics of the time are kind of separating them and pulling them apart, you know, and it takes certain tragedies to really bring them back together. But that's the case with almost all of the characters in the play. Like Rick said, they're incredibly rich and well-drawn. And almost all of them don't behave well in certain moments, but to me that's very human. I mean, we're all built upon contradictions, and you know, people are doing admirable things, but yet, you know, not everyone might see what they're doing as being admirable. You know, and Ned is a case in point. That yes, he's very passionate and you're very powerful in what he's trying to do, but yet how he goes about it, is that the most effective way? You know, and a lot of the other characters disagree and they don't think it's the most effective way. And we get a lot of tension because of those disagreements. So it's very, very interesting.
You know, it was so much chaos at the time, you know, because people were dying. And by 1985, 1986, they almost started dropping like flies everywhere. It required kind of all these different forces coming together in a way. You know, when I saw it, the play 25 or 30 years ago, or 25 or 26 years ago, something like that, and then I saw the movie, and now I'm going to see the staged reading, and I'm wondering, I can't remember 25 years ago, you know, how much different it might have been from the movie might have been from the play. But does it change over time, or is it just that our perspective changes, Elliot?
I mean, for the film, they had to change certain aspects of it. And I've actually purposefully not watched the film as to not color my interpretation of the play.
At all? You haven't watched it?
I have not.
Okay.
I've just spent my time with the text itself and with the play. But for film, when you're adapting for film, you need to change the source material, because a play is written to be performed for a public audience and film is very, very different. But I think our perspective has changed and broadened since the time the play originally premiered in 1985. And, you know, I think we bring something new to seeing it, but I think the play also brings new things. Like at the time it was first produced, as Rick said, it was more of a polemic, just a very angry piece of theater, because it was about educating and getting people out in the streets and
activating
getting people to fight
them,
and activating them. And now it's still very much about activating people and showing that we need to fight for what we believe in, but we can see the heart beneath it. You know, and the love between many of these characters and how they depend on each other, you know, and rely upon each other.
Because as a society, we're more open-minded?
Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah, absolutely. And also we have the 30 years, you know, of reflection upon this piece.
Rick Warr, who do you want to see this? Everybody, of course, always, but you can't fit that many people into your theater. So who do you want to see this?
Well, I hate to exclude anybody,
of
but
course.
I think that what's important is that people who did not live through this see it and understand the history. It is a major moment in gay history. It's helped us as gay people become who we are today. And I think you. This was an era before cell phones, before MTV, before anything, and the ability to communicate. I think we want people to see it who will be moved by it, and who will realize that activism pays off. That activism is necessary, no matter how many treatments there are out there.
You know, what does it bring to it, or how do you think it affects a play, a story, when the person who's writing it is well known. It's pretty autobiographical. Larry Kramer is
he is Ned Weeks.
He's Ned Weeks, and I'm just wondering how that changes or affects, maybe is the better word. It's hard to know change. That's a tree in a forest question, but how it affects, in your opinion, artistically.
Well, now, you can sense his raw emotion in the play. I mean, yeah. Like what Ned is feeling, Larry Kramer certainly felt. You know, and all of the other characters in the play are based upon real people that he knew at the time. You know, and I think it's sometimes difficult to balance the autobiographical with the artistic, because you're living it and you feel it so much that you don't necessarily have that separation to step away and kind of look at it more as a story or as a plot, you know, for theater. And but I think he manages to move past that it's not about Larry Kramer. It's not Larry Kramer's play. It becomes about so much more. And the fact that he was able to kind of toggle that when he first wrote it is absolutely remarkable.
It's amazing. And Rick Gore, just tell people who might not be familiar with the idea of a staged reading how it works and what they'll see and hear.
Well, it's a somewhat vague term. They're going to see an almost produced show. A stage reading is actors typically will still have the scripts in their hands, and there will not be a lot of set. There will not be a lot of costumes. This is going to be somewhere in between, because the actors, many of them are almost off their books right now, and which is wonderful because it allows them to get more into their characters, and they're not just reading something. But there will be some reference to the actual script with the books in their hands. But there will be staging, there are costumes, there are some props, and it's set in the very intimate green room that we have, so that you're right there on top of them as the discoveries evolve.
And you have some other events scheduled around the stage readings over
yes.
the weekend?
Yes, there'll be a talk back after every show. Tonight, there'll be a dramaturgical talk back led by Elliot and the actors. The Equitas Health is bringing in Mimi Rivard, who is one of their experts, after the Friday night performance to talk about some of the issues you talked about earlier in this hour. And then Kate Adams will be attending a free reception that's being sponsored by the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. And that will be in between the matinee and the evening shows. And that will, again, be talking and taking questions on pharmaceutical evolutions.
And Kate Adams being my recent guest, just on the last segment, pharmacy manager and clinical specialist at the AIDS Healthcare Foundation in Columbus. Stage readings, do you have a preference, Elliot?
I would always prefer a full production of anything.
Okay.
But as Rick said, what we're trying to do with this is come as close to a full production as we can. You know, so there's a lot of staging. I mean, this play is incredibly interactive.
Yeah.
You know, there's just a lot of movement and a lot of emotion, and the stakes are so high throughout the whole play, you know, that I certainly wanted to honor it, you know, with what I was doing.
I like staged readings because it's sort of like radio in a way that you fill in the blanks with what makes sense to you and reference points the individual has. So I like it all, of course, but I'm looking forward to it. And thank you, Elliot Lemberg, for joining us today to talk about it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Elliot Lemberg is the director of A Normal Heart. It's going to be a stage reading at the Short North Stage beginning tonight and throughout the weekend. If you're interested, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And also, Rick Gore, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate your time.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Rick Gore is co-founder and executive director of the Short North Stage. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.